All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight, we're going to be celebrating a little bit of the Chinese New Year mixed with a little Valentine's Day. So, of course, the most appropriate film for that is one of Snobby Bobby's favorites, and that is Big Trouble in Little China by one John Carpenter. And we will be doing the show notes at actualanarchy.com/220 for this one. And before we introduce him in the last night's portion of the show, let's check in with Robert, who last week was telling us about how there were regulations requiring that he keep his restaurant door open during the Arctic blast polar vortex, thus freezing himself, his crew, and his customers. And then, perhaps unrelated, he has been sick for about a week. So, Robert, how are you doing? Are you feeling better?
I have mildly recovered. If I bolt out of frame suddenly, it's because I need to vomit. It's been surprisingly fun. It's the worst part of being sick, and it's the worst part of recovery for me. I usually end in this like the phlegmy mess. And without going into too much details, it's quite disgusting. So I'm enjoying it. You're enjoying it. We'll all try enjoying it. I'll try and speak as clearly with as few cough breaks as possible, but I can't promise anything. God Emperor Inslee has finally decreed that we are allowed to go into like phase two or something. I don't know. I don't really pay attention to whatever decrees this or that, but I hear that we're allowed to seat at 25% capacity. So we will now not have to have the door open, which is a big win for public health, in my opinion.
Right. Especially when it's like 7 out, which it is going to be soon in Texas, where our guest is from. So let's introduce him when we get to the last night's portion of the show, right after these messages. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson, and we are the Last Nighters. You can find us on the lastnighters.com and also on the Liberty Movement's YouTube channel. We're going to be doing an episode on Big Trouble in Little China tonight, so we're going to shake the pillars of heaven with our buddy Snobby Bobby from the Not For Everyone podcast. This is one of his favorite films, and in fact, is one of his monikers he uses on some social media platforms. It is, of course, Pork Chop Express, which is the big rig that Kurt Russell drives in this one. So, welcome to the show, Snobby Bobby. It's been since around Christmas, we had you on for Contact, and before that, Demolition Man and the Mel Gibson classic, The Patriot. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's really great to be back talking about, as you said, one of my favorite movies ever made.
Right. And this one, I think, is kind of really up your alley because your show sort of borders on movies that are like sort of just below this level. Like this seems to be the cutoff line, you know, like most of the movies you do are B or lower kind of style. And so I think this is still a little bit in your wheelhouse. And I never mentioned the show notes page, but it's going to be lastnarrow.com/163 tonight for this one. But if you could also maybe just embellish a little bit, what do you do on your podcast? Who is your host or co-host? And what's your, what do you got in the docket? What's your next couple episodes going to be about?
Yeah, just to sum up, dovetail off what you just said there, let me put it to you this way. We worship at the shrine of at the altar of Kurt Russell and worship this movie along with The Thing and Escape from New York and things of that nature. But as far as the show goes, the only Kurt Russell movie we've ever covered is Tango and Cash. So I think that will kind of give you a good idea of what we're about. But basically, it's just a me and my co-host Adam, who is a giant man baby, who he's just one of those guys that you're friends with him. He's got a heart of gold, and he's a good person. But like, if you bring him around people that don't already know him, you're like, yeah, all right, like settle down over there. Like, like kind of embarrassing, but at the same time, it's like, well, I'm already friends with you, so I can't really do anything about it. He's fine with me saying all this. So the premise of the show is really us just watching and talking about movies and just general pop culture and things like that. But also doing that pal around guy, locker room talk, smack talk to each other, if that makes sense. But yeah, the first half of the show is us just kind of doing our normal banter about whatever's going on in the world and talk about some of the movies we watched lately. And then the back nine of the show is we cover a weird schlocky movie, generally things that are not for everyone, hence the name Not For Everyone Podcast.
Right. And I've actually gotten Robert to listen to you guys, and I think it's a lot of fun. You guys are really jovial, and it feels like you're almost part of the conversation, which I do enjoy. And it's well polished, so I highly recommend that people do check you guys out.
Thank you. I don't know if polished is a word that I would use, but I'll take it.
But you put a lot of lipstick on that pig. How about that?
Yes, you're not the first person that said that to me to describe the show. So yeah, that's kind of the goal here.
And I don't mean it in a disparaging way.
No, I take it as a compliment, because we don't want to do another horror movie podcast about all the standards that everyone's talked about ad nauseum. Like, you got to do something a little, you know, subvert expectations a little bit. So it's more about us talking shit to each other and just using something familiar to the audience as a vehicle to do that. And I don't know, it wasn't intentionally like that. It just, that's how it kind of turned out.
Yeah, I think it works great. You guys are doing a good job. And we sort of attempt to do a similar thing, but to inject some philosophy and economics
right
into it. I've heard you mention us on other shows as we're a little bit more highbrow, which I do take a little bit of contention with, because I don't think we're that bright, but it is a lot of fun to do these shows.
I realized this, and I know that they talk about echo chambers a lot and how, you know, you got to get outside of your echo chamber and get exposed to different perspectives. But as far as like our ilk of people, like, no, not even just, this isn't even confirmation bias, but like, people outside of our echo chamber are kind of dumb. Kind of lowbrow, you know? I don't know.
All right. Well, Robert, you want to get any comments in before we get to the Google description, how we usually start these things off?
No, I got to limit my talk time tonight. Sorry. I hate to deprive you of my incredible wit and insight, but let's move it along.
All right.
We will do so. He's going to turn into a pumpkin in about an hour, I think. So
Robert's in quickie mode.
That's right. Okay, so John Carpenter's Big Trouble in Little China came out in 1986, PG-13, action/fantasy film, 1 hour and 39 minutes, 7.3 on IMDb, 78% Rotten Tomatoes, 4.8 out of 5 on Shout Factory. It's like Jeb. 93% of Google users liked it. The description reads, Kurt Russell plays hard-boiled truck driver Jack Burton, who gets caught in a bizarre conflict within and underneath San Francisco's Chinatown. An ancient Chinese prince and Chinatown crime lord has kidnapped a beautiful green-eyed woman who is the fiancée to Jack's best friend. Jack must help his friend rescue the girl before the evil Lo Pan uses her to break the ancient curse that keeps him a fleshless and immortal spirit. Came out July 1st, 1986. Director is John Carpenter. And had a box office of $11.1 million, which was about not even half of the budget. So this was kind of panned and a bit of a box office disaster. I think that this was the last big studio film that John Carpenter did, and it left a salty taste in his mouth. So he went to independent films. However, he has said that this is one of his most proud achievements. He does like this movie, but he didn't like the experience with the big studio. I think it was Fox at the time. So, Robert, let's go to you for your opening on this in your limited capacity. Your 25% capacity due to decrees.
Okay. Well, I hadn't seen this since probably the 80s. Probably a video cassette in a VCR with little scan lines going across it. That's probably my last experience with this thing. And of course, I would have been, you know, like 10, 11, 12 at the most. So my experience here was a lot different. I'm curious because, you know, Bobby says this is one of his favorite movies of all time.
Uh-oh.
And just because I say that doesn't mean I'm going to be super negative.
Okay.
But it does mean that I'm not going to be overly positive.
That's fine. That's why we need you here, Robert.
So, Big Trouble in Little China. It's a campy, tongue-in-cheek, intentionally so, right, little adventure movie with kind of like the action-adventure-y tropes of the time, but kind of cranked up a little bit, maybe more a little bit comic booky, with a lot of like silly schlocky type elements. Just not taking itself ever seriously, like at all. I thought it was fun that, I don't know if this is true, but I mean, it has to be, right? That like Raiden and Shao Kahn from Mortal Kombat are inspired by this movie. I mean, they just have to be, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And John Carpenter should be getting checks.
He should, right? Right. I mean, they should just straight up just copy and paste it, basically. But, you know, I think it's impossible to hate the movie since it doesn't really take itself too seriously. It's just having a campy good time. But I also didn't see a whole lot that really enamored me to it. Like there weren't a lot of big laughs. There weren't a lot of even a whole lot of happy, fun smileys. There were some, don't get me wrong. But I found the story to be in too much of a hurry to get it over with and wrap it up and even start. Like none of the characters other than the main two characters, really.
Jack Burton and Wang.
And Wang are even given an introduction, which I found really jarring. Like they'll just be going along and all of a sudden a character will appear and they'll just be talking like they've been in the movie the whole time. And just like, what? No, who's this person? Why do they act like they know each other? What's going on? Why aren't we told who this person is? Like in sense that, you know, what they're going to do, how they're going to be. Give me some kind of character moment that's going to tell me how I'm supposed to like take in this person. But they're just kind of thrown into this movie. And, you know, it's other than that, I really didn't have a whole lot of trouble with it. The finale, other than being a giant like letdown, I thought the big kung fu fight in the mall, the strip mall, I don't know, the mall basement or whatever it was, where the escalator that went down, you know, that whole thing was a lot of fun in his lair. But then the way he died, I thought that was kind of just really didn't feel satisfying. But overall, I mean, I'd have to say this is like one of those cult classics that you should probably see once, but I just don't think there's enough there to really endear itself to require multiple viewings or across multiple generations. It just didn't have enough charm for me. Maybe if I had seen it back in the day and really, really loved it, and then this is like a more of a nostalgia trip for me, I would just be just super charmed by it. But for me, it was just, it felt kind of flat. And not that Kurt Russell isn't great. I mean, you're talking to a guy who loves The Thing, like one of his top horror movies of all time. Just like top, probably top three, top four. And this to me was just not, it just didn't have the charm and the good times. I just didn't, a movie like this, I should be like smiling my way through, kind of like a rewatch of like a Goonies or, right. I don't even know what, but it just didn't do that for me.
Yeah. So Bobby, you've mentioned this is one of your favorites, and I think you watched it a couple of times in the last week or two in preparation for this. So you actually do show or have exhibited that there is rewatchability to this. So what is different for you that Robert's not seeing? Is it your man crush on Kurt Russell, or is this like a seminal thing that you watched, you know, at a certain like important time in your life, and so it brings you back to that?
I actually didn't really watch this growing up. I may have seen it once or twice. A friend showed it to me in college when I was really getting into, I was kind of moving past the like pretentious art house phase and starting to just get into like kind of weird gems and more, I guess, lowbrow stuff. But that, I mean, To Robert's point, I would say that yes, my one complaint is that it's a little crowded as far as characters go, but that is, for me, that is so forgivable. And and one of the best things about it is that it is so fast paced, but that is one of the flaws, that, you know, the byproducts of a fast paced movie is like, you're like, who the fuck are these people? And there's always these kind of like lines of dialogue that vaguely will introduce, you know, Gracie or what's that guy's name, like the kind of chubbier, like there's like Eddie Lee and Margot, like those characters didn't need to be in this movie, but it's like whatever. So yeah, I mean, I can kind of see, I'm definitely blinded by nostalgia, but that doesn't, by nostalgia doesn't go past, you know, 20 years ago at the same time. Would you like me to start my initial thoughts now?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's do initial thoughts.
Because that was my response to Robert's initial thoughts.
Yeah.
All right. There are a plethora of words that could be used to describe John Carpenter's 1986 Big Trouble in Little China, like charming. I had charming written down before you even said it's not.
No
charming.
Way. No way.
I swear to God. All right. Let me start over. There are a plethora of words that could be used to describe John Carpenter's 1986 Big Trouble in Little China, like charming, sublime, superb, an objective masterpiece. But on its most fundamental level, this movie is the epitome of entertainment. There's not a single scene in this movie that I am not enthralled by. And as many times as I've seen it, every time I watch it, I'm reminded of so many good scenes or lines of dialogue or character interactions that I never caught or I'd kind of forgotten about, because there are so many of them in this movie. I honestly, you know, to each their own, Robert, when you say there's no laugh out loud funny parts in this movie, that is one of the most insane things I've ever heard in my life. And as funny as this movie is, and it is funny, the characters play everything so straight-faced. It's like, it's funny, but they don't know they're in a comedy. Like, if you met Jack Burton in real life, Kurt Russell's character, any reasonable person would immediately think, like, who the fuck is this guy? Like, but in the context of the film, he's just supposed to be a typical blue-collar, smarmy guy that's, again, obnoxious in real life, and kind of a shady douchebag in real life, but like he's so lovable and wonderful, and the every word that comes out of his mouth is just pure supreme gold weaving from a Rumpelstiltskin's gold weaver. I don't know where it's going. He added that last part.
Just like that.
You can just like cough that. Like that every time you disagree with me.
Now, I did enjoy Kurt Russell's bravado and delivery in this. So I think that he kind of has that kind of same tone in a lot of his films.
He's doing a John Wayne impression in this movie.
Yeah.
If you didn't, yeah. He was like trying to just be an over the top John Wayne type character. So yeah, like you say, Robert, you'd mentioned you don't really get, like, they just kind of throw you into it. I'm like, yes, there's not a lot of like, let's get to know these characters and kind of this, like, let's take our time to understand who these people are and what their motivations are. It's like, nope, here's an opening montage of Jack Burton driving a truck, just saying smarmy shit into a CB radio. That's hilarious. You're like, you know exactly who this guy is.
Right. And Jack gets a perfect introduction. I'm on board with his character the whole movie. But then you get Wang, you get him at the poker table.
Mm-hmm.
You have no idea until he starts 1v10ing master martial artist that he is the greatest martial artist in the world. And he could just smoke anybody if he wants. You have no idea.
He's Chinese.
Okay, so he's Chinese, so that means he could beat up anybody, basically the entire Chinatown. He can just take
Robert
on all by himself.
Robert.
Yes, sir.
He's Chinese.
Bobby, I understand that, and that is the extent of his character. I understand, that's fine. But yeah, it didn't I, really, I get,
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, okay. Let me ask you this.
Okay.
Did you buy the romance? Because there was there a reason beyond these are the two main lead characters for them to get together? Or was it just the trope that they are making fun of and you're not supposed to buy it and that's why it's funny?
I'm not going to take the Demolition Man defense on that question or on this movie. When you say romance, who are you talking about? Because this is a very important important question you're bringing up here.
There are several romances.
I'll explain why.
None of them have any basis in reality. But now I'm talking about
this movie has a Sasquatch creature.
I understand that. I understand the ridiculousness of the movie. But okay, what am I supposed to believe? Am I supposed to believe anything on screen?
No, it's a movie.
I'm not supposed to get involved. Because if I don't believe anything that's happening and I'm not on board with what's happening, there's no stakes for the characters. There's no reason for me to worry about them. I don't care what happens. I'm just there for a happy, fun ride. That's fine, but it needs to be a happy, fun ride.
Let's pump the brakes. Let's pump the brakes and let's rewind for a second.
On the Pork Chop Express.
You mentioned romance. Now, what particular characters?
I don't know. So there's the Wang and the green-eyed lady from China. Not worried about that. He's liked her forever, and there's some kind of thing there, and he's been working all his way to get her over here. Mm-hmm. But there's Kurt Russell just elbowing up, shouldering up aside to the, I don't know, what's the other lady?
Gracie.
Okay, the other green-haired, green-eyed lady. The other green-eyed lady.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed.
And they have zero interaction between them that would lead them to romance, other than they both are in the same movie and they are the ones that are not in romantic relations with anybody other characters.
Well,
I'll
disagree. They go through a harrowing experience together.
What happened, Daniel?
They're going through a harrowing experience together, which bonds them. And then they also have, when going through the tunnels, they have to brush up against each other. There's physical contact that is sort of unavoidable. And Kurt Russell, you know, he's got to drop a few lines in there and kind of make it super awkward. But I also think there is an element of them trying to make it purposefully like awkward and sort of making fun of the action movie that has the leading man and the lady get together.
Right, the Demolition Man event.
I think this is one of the greatest love stories ever told.
Come on, man.
I think the chemistry, I think like so much of the appeal of this movie is the interactions between Gracie Law, Kim Cattrall, and Jack Burton, Kurt Russell. Like, it just, the airport scene when he first approaches her and how they're, it's kind of, it's almost a Han Solo, Leia, Empire Strikes Back thing where they're just.
Exact same thing I was going to say. It's very much that, but done way, way worse.
But like turned up to 11 and hilarious. I adamantly disagree with everything you just said.
That's fair enough.
That's fair enough.
We can agree that you're a good person somehow and completely disagree on this movie.
Right. We can agree that you are a well-read, good-hearted man of integrity.
And have seen many films. Exactly.
Incredibly wrong about this.
Right. That's exactly correct.
We need to do a thing episode. It's like, we should be friends.
We should do one where we both agree on something and just cheer about a movie the whole time.
Yeah.
No, Daniel, I haven't heard your thoughts, Daniel. I don't want you to just be the moderator here.
Yeah. I should actually be between you two on the screen here. You know, kind of keep you separated, off-screen style.
Otherwise, wait.
That's right. No. Some fisticuffs may break out here. I was just going to say, you know, not only do I like Kurt Russell's bravado, but I also like the fact that he can't back it up. But he's courageous, you know, he's brave, and he's willing to go and do these things. But every time he goes to try to do these things, he has some pratfall that happens. Like, he comes out too late, or he gets hit by the debris that comes down and hits him in the head. Same thing happens when he first approaches the Kim Cattrall at the airport. So he's one of those guys who's like overconfident and he overestimates what he's capable of doing, but he's not afraid to do those things. And I think that's kind of endearing, but it's also very much different than what you'd expect in action movies, you know, where you have the characters with bravado and then they go out and do some amazing thing. They have plot armor and unlimited ammunition and that kind of a thing. You don't really have that here. So I think it is playing against some tropes. And I think that's what part of the fun is. That adds to the comic book style of it.
That's the comedy of this entire movie. You just summed it up. It's the juxtaposition between, okay, here's this action hero that's on the cover of the poster. And you look at it, you're like, oh, it's muscle bound like Kurt Russell in a like action adventure film. But he's a total bumbling buffoon, like of like Homer Simpson level status with confidence. And that's what, but like he pulls it off so well, and his the overconfidence that comes through in his dialogue and his one-liners and everything. That's why it's not what you expect. That's what makes it so fucking funny. That's my argument.
Okay. Here's some sacrilege, I guess I'm about to say.
Oh, more
sacrilege for you to chew on there, Bobby. So I was recently rewatching Airplane for probably the 15th time. And
great film.
It is great. You have to be in a certain frame of mind to get all the humor and really do all this. But one thing that movie does really well is timing. The jokes land because of the timing. And in this movie, I wonder if John Carpenter wasn't the best director for it, because so much of maybe the editing didn't come together. I don't know. But a lot of the beats and the timing on the jokes didn't quite land because we were already moving off onto another thing and we didn't have time for the jokes to breathe. I don't exactly know. I can't quite put my finger on it, but I have to say that maybe I didn't laugh so much because it just wasn't quite edited for comedy. It was more edited for an action adventure. It's like the director was trying to make a comedy. The editor thought it was an action adventure, and the editor turned it into an action adventure. Now you're still getting some comedic lines in there. You can see that the director's still trying to tell jokes, but they're not quite landing. Maybe they landed for you. I understand that, but they didn't land for me. Maybe because it just wasn't quite put together. Timing is so important in comedy.
Yeah. There's one point where I noticed that where they hung a beat too long, where Kurt Russell like was on screen doing nothing for a second or two. And then they tried to do the one liner and then they just immediately cut to something else. I can't recall exactly where it was, but it did stand out a little bit. And I think that is an editing thing. So I think there's,
thank you for agreeing with everything I said, Daniel. Yes.
No, I don't disagree with what you just said, but I don't think that that's I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing in this case, because like I'd mentioned earlier, this is a comedy that's cut like an action adventure film. This is a comedy that's, again, it's almost meta in a sense. Like the characters don't know they're in a comedy. This is just the world they're in. And I think that that's to its credit that it doesn't sit there and wink, wink, like, hey, audience, isn't that funny? Nudge, nudge. Like, this is the part where you laugh. It just keeps going and going and going. And like I'd mentioned earlier, there's things I catch in this movie because of that make it so rewatchable. Is there's things you don't pick up on sometimes. It's some interactions that are, like, if it did give it time to breathe, you would have noticed it the first time. I understand what you're saying. I understand your point, but I don't in this particular context, because I feel like it was pulled off. I don't find that to be a like negative quality of this film.
Okay. So do you think that it was definitely intentional, or do you think that this is some sort of happy coincidence where you really, it's gelling together for you into this perfect movie type thing, where I see it as more of like misfiring?
Probably a little bit of both, because I know that the comedy and the parody and the tropes and that kind of stuff, in the over the top, you know, embellishment of these types of characters, I know that that was all intentional. Like there's the scene, I laughed my ass off. I never really noticed it until this week when I rewatched it for the show. But the scene where Wang is running across, it's towards the end. Wang is fighting, I think, Peter Kwong in this scene, or no, Carter Thunder character, the lightning guy or whatever.
Okay. The Raiden character.
No, lightning's a different guy. Anyway, they're in Lopan's domain, and it's just a shot of them running across, fighting back and forth in another room, and the audience is in a different room watching this through the doorway, and it's just this constant like furniture flying everywhere and like high karate kicks going across, you know, panning across the screen, all this crazy shit's happening. And I'm just like, this is fucking brilliant. It's like real comedy. So that said, it's it's not unintentionally funny, but it's also like, I get what you're saying as far as like, it doesn't pander to the audience to let them digest those jokes. It just keeps
going. Yeah. That's the issue, is just the mixing of tones, right? You got the comedy tone, you got the action adventure tone. And sometimes like a Marvel movie will try and meld those together, and they'll have their beats where they have their funny jokes and then they'll go back to action. Mm-hmm. But this movie's more like it's melding the two at the same time. And maybe it just didn't work for me. Maybe I've been trained wrongly. I don't know, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you know that the original screenplay for this was to have this set as a Western in like the 1800s? But still have the whole, you know, Pan and the Chinese mythology and all of that kind of boiled into it. And so they had another screenwriter like make sense of that, because apparently the original draft was not very sensible. And
this was the sensible draft that came out.
Clearly.
Yeah. But what his argument was, well, if we're going to have the, you know, the Chinese cultural history and Chinatown and all that stuff, then adding another 100 years back into the old West is going to just totally remove the audience from this. So it's better to base it in more modern time, you know, 1986 time, so that the audience watching it doesn't have to wonder where we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that does, you know, help to streamline it and make a little bit more sense out of it. Though this is one of those stories where they don't tell you really enough plot wise to really understand what's going on. You sort of have to piece it together in retrospect. Like, when the gang members go to the airport to get that first, the girl that Gracie was going to help with immigration status or whatever. And then that gets foiled by Kurt Russell doing something. And then they end up taking
Mao Yin.
Mao Yin, yeah. And it's not clear that gang is like, are they part of the shadowy underworld, the mysticism that we see later? Or are they like... Apparently it was to put them into sex slavery, and there's like a brothel and all of that. But I guess upon my, you know, viewing 30 years ago when I was a kid, and then viewing it again, like I didn't catch on that it was really a brothel until like sort of after the fact. And I feel like that kind of information is helpful. So you kind of, I don't know, have a better grasp of like who's doing what and why, because we're sort of like go into this and then they leave and then they come back and then they go into the dungeons and whatnot. And it's not like clear how that makes sense.
Yeah, there's the whole series of like people in cages that they ultimately kind of free, but who are they? What are they doing there? I mean, I know the heroes are there being captured or whatever, but then there's a whole bunch of other people down there too.
And my
I don't know.
Pointed this out. Gracie was tied up and bound, but the reporter girl was able to write in her journal.
Well, she had a story to write, Daniel. Come on now.
Right.
Apparently out loud as she was writing it.
Yeah. They respected her professional integrity there. But yeah, so those cages.
Finally,
I mean,
someone who respects journalists.
I guess, was that like where the sex slaves were kept, but then there are rooms where the Johns would meet them? Like, is that like the front of this place? I don't know. It didn't make a whole lot of sense. And how is like David Lo Pan associated with this?
This is all just typical Chinese mafia stuff that you're talking about here. This is just how it's done.
It's like Black Rain.
Yeah. Yes, it's like Black Rain. I don't know. I think I think those are solid points, but I think that a lot of what you brought, it's just for aesthetic effect, as it's what this world is and what it looks like and what we're dealing with. And I think that there is a lot of very quick lines of dialogue that arguably kind of like lazily, but in a charming way, explain what's going on, because Gracie Law mentions like, oh, those are like dangerous men from Chinatown or whatever, and you're like, oh, okay, I couldn't tell that by their weird sunglasses and
I love the
like
sunglasses.
Weapons, yeah. and then you're like, okay, well, what does that mean? Like, okay, why are you know? And then it does leave you to kind of piece it together, and you're right, it does, like, you throw like Kurt Russell's character Jack Burton does the Henry Swanson thing where he dresses like he infiltrates the brothel and looks for the girl with the green eyes, and then it kind of like has this whole sequence of events that happens from that situation, and then they leave and get the guy from Prince of Darkness. God, what is that guy's name? Victor Wong, Egg Shen's character and his, the good guy's character, and then they go back into the dungeon. Like, yeah, that, it feels like they could have just like kept it going, but I think it needed a break there. But yeah, you're right. The expositions are a little frazzled, a little fragmented, and it doesn't spell things out for you. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think you would expect it to spell things out for you for a movie like this, but it for whatever reason just doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes when something's overexplained, it's like, oh, come on, you know. And,
right.
But yeah, this one, I think you're right. Like Egg Shen maybe should have been more involved a little earlier on, and not in that like pre-movie scene where he's like talking to the lawyer.
I think that was added to the movie after they made it, because the studio was like, we need more. I think it was like something to do with like, we need more explanation as to what's going on, to your right. point, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
And I think that was just to make it clear that Jack Burton actually did do something heroic in this film, because later on when you're watching it, what does he actually do?
Right. So that brings up what I was getting at, what I was trying to get to when Robert was talking about romance in this movie. That's what's fun about it too, is the hero is the sidekick and the sidekick is the hero. Like, Wang is
a real Green Hornet situation.
Yes. Wang is the hero here. He's going to save the girl with green eyes, his fiance, who is the person that was kidnapped by the villain, the damsel in distress. Jack Burton's just along for the ride. He just wants to get his truck back, and Wang owes him money from the bottle slicing bet that they made earlier in the movie, which, by the way, that speaks to Jack Burton's character too, is like how adamant he is about like getting his good friend to like pay up, like he's gonna follow him around town. I'm like, that's kind of a dick move, just like, he's poor and like, just let him get you your money whenever, you know. But it's whatever, like it doesn't matter. So when you ask me about the romance, like, yes, there is a romance between Jack Burton and Gracie Law, and again, he's the sidekick, he's the bumbling buffoon with a heart of gold, and then Wang, who is a little underdeveloped, is the hero in this movie, like a sidekick would be underdeveloped. I've never seen it before.
Yeah. Fair point. No, it's unique. I think it's unique because it doesn't really work, and that's why nobody's like copied it.
If we weren't
just a thought,
right,
just
now.
A thought.
No, that's fine. That's fine. That's fine, Robert.
I don't hate the movie. I just don't love it. I don't know it wasn't anything that endeared me to it. You know, it's got whole bunch of fun elements.
I think it's good to hear I don't want to say negative, but like critical feedback about this movie, because I am in this like echo chamber of like just fanboys that love this shit, and we all just sit around and talk about how great it is. And it is interesting to hear someone that doesn't have nostalgia for it come out and say, oh, by the way, this movie's a piece of shit. So thanks for that, Robert.
I think I remember watching this with you, Robert, back when we were kids. I think it was maybe on HBO at the time, because you had HBO back then.
Yeah, that's right. I did. Yeah. Yeah, I was one of the very fortunate ones back when it cost like, I don't even know how much it cost, but it was like an extra $80 a month or whatever it was to tack it on to basic cable, which was also exorbitant, whatever it was. I don't even remember.
So I have a question for you guys. Because I didn't really think in these terms, and I wanted to see how you would pull it off. Like, do y'all have any kind of, I guess, Rothbardian applications to this movie?
Well, I'm glad he had his truck insured, I guess.
The insurance trafficking, trying to screw him.
If we legalized prostitution, we wouldn't have to deal with black markets and mafioso Chinese mystics running things. There's that.
Rackets would be no way.
The thing that you didn't like about him following his friend around for making those bets, he was making him honor the contract that they made, you know. So I like that.
It's grasping at straws. I love it. No, yeah, that's true. That's true. We have to, if we want to live in this ideal world of voluntary interaction, we have to pay up on our bets without getting, you know, state authorities involved.
Right,
it's legal anyway to. Gamble.
Their betting reminded me of Robert and my betting during the football season, where I just kept making terrible, terrible bets. And then I finally evened out.
finally got lucky on one, and there you go. Just keep double earning or nothing it. Never expecting to pay out until it just rises and rises and rises. And eventually it'll flatten out and you'll be done betting.
Yeah, I found out.
Noticed there wasn't any big Super Bowl bets out of you.
No, but I was pulling for the GOAT. And I hated that guy for years, you know, when he was part of the Patriot machine. But when he left and then he started getting disparaged by people for reasons that don't make a lot of sense, it kind of made me like him, you know?
There are enough reasons to hate Tom Brady. You don't have to go the mainstream media NPC route of not liking him because of his white privilege and not wanting to wear a mask or whatever. You can hate him because he's won like a jillion everythings and, you know, it's time for him to step off. That's why.
I think the NFL's rigged.
You felt like that was a predetermined outcome?
Yeah. No, not really. Maybe. I don't know. Who knows? I mean, there is Inflategate with all that. But I will say I despise the New England Patriots, and I found it a lot easier to digest and verbally acknowledge that Tom Brady is a pretty good quarterback after this Tampa Bay Buccaneers Super Bowl. So, you know, if anyone can get Tampa Bay a Super Bowl, that would be the guy.
Yeah, I'm begrudgingly finding some things to admire about Tom Brady. It's really annoying, and I hope Daniel will stop sending me things.
He's like a Wayne Gretzky or a Michael Jordan, I would say. Like, he's up there. He is. I'm sorry.
He's got more rings now than Jordan, right?
Yeah, one more, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think cray. The fact that he did it on another team in a totally different system, different coach, I think that adds to the lore and legacy a little bit.
And the fact that I would say a quarterback is more crucial to winning a game than, say, like anyone can score points in a basketball game. I don't remember what position Michael Jordan played, but yeah.
Point guard.
Yeah.
Shooting guard.
No, he was both, but yes.
Yeah.
I liked him in Space Jam.
That's a good one. We should do that one.
So... How does Hoppe work into Space Jam?
So, Robert, I wanted to ask you, I know that you've watched a bunch of like History Channel stuff and you've kind of dug in a little bit to like Chinese history, like the Han Dynasty and the first emperor and those types of things. I remember we talked about this in, what was that movie?
Hero.
Hero. Yeah. Long ago, a couple years ago. Now, I vaguely remember what we were discussing in that one. But
nice, Daniel.
That's what I mean. They were referring to legitimate, like, first emperor history in this movie, right? And then they're adding some mysticism and lore on top of it.
Yeah, I think they took some real stuff and then added in a bunch of fake stuff, of course. Yeah, to give it some weight. But they barely touched on it for more than a brief second when he was talking about, you know, this Lopan guy and why he's been alive for thousands of years. They didn't really explain how that's possible. He's been cursed. He's a ghost, sort of, maybe. Yes, no, who knows? Mm-hmm. It's all supposed to just be, you know, silly fun, and you're not supposed to take it too seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a Sasquatch in the movie, or I don't know, whatever that thing is.
Yeah. Bobby likes it. Bobby's a big Sasquatch guy.
That's definitely a selling point, a strong attribute of this film is the Sasquatch. I was going to ask you guys, so y'all are on the West Coast. Is Chinese mafia like a thing that y'all acknowledge and fear?
I think if you go down to San Francisco, the triads are still a thing, but you don't see them so much around here. There's probably some sort of Seattle variant of the triads that you would think, but I never really got wind of that in my time in Seattle. Did you, Daniel? Daniel actually lived there for quite a while.
Yeah, and I used to hang out with a buddy of mine I went to college with, and he lived in Seattle. He's what they call an ABC, American-born Chinese. So we would go out to the bars and whatnot and then always end up in Chinatown for late night, like 1 or 2 in the morning at the 24-hour restaurants eating down there. And I was, of course, the, you know, the goofy honky with my Chinese friend. And we did that for a couple of years. But
I saw was a Jack Burton.
Yeah. Only not as much bravado, I think. But I remember seeing some shady stuff down there, but I don't think it was anything like triad level, you know.
It was it like Green Lightning, Green Flames, and Raiden?
Yeah,
and,
Raiden was down there.
Thanks, Susong.
Fucking Sub-Zero. and all the rest, you know, Scorpion. Now I saw some, you know, like, you know, street hustle, drug shit, and just deals go down and things like that. But
which is all races.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just because it was, you know, south of downtown. So it's a little rougher down there.
Mm-hmm.
A little older. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for whatever it's worth, I've never been intimidated or felt intimidated or a threat by like a gathering of Chinese people. But
your white privilege talking.
It's my white privilege, and yeah, and despite all the stereotypes of the kung fu and the gangs or the mafia and stuff, and they just seem like nice folks, except for the ones that gave us the virus.
We were not supposed to say that anymore. Apparently, was that an executive order?
I'm making a point to say it now.
One of like 100.
What?
One of like 100 executive orders? Wasn't that one of them?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Wild stuff. All right. Well, we should probably start to wind down before too long here. Robert, you had opened with there was a disappointing culmination or climax in this. So give us what was your issue there?
So there's a final fight between, you know, anytime you're watching these like action adventure movies, you're looking for the final confrontation, the final fight to be really epic. And if it's a martial arts movie, you need that final fight to really be amazing. And if you watch a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, Jackie Chan movie, Jet Li movie, Bruce Lee movie, you know what I'm talking about. There's like the final boss and they really know their kung fu and it's awesome. In this movie, you're pitting Jack Burton versus a geriatric wizard guy, and you've got Wang versus the bodyguard, executive, super strong martial artist guy. That, like Bobby was talking about earlier with the comedy scene, like the things getting thrown back and forth, the furniture, that's actually pretty epic. And then there's, for some reason, the Raiden character jumps in and then he's part of it. But that's like when they're escaping. But the actual time where he just knifes Lopan in the head, like, I know they set it up earlier with him having great reflexes catching the bottle, but that wasn't a satisfying destruction of Lopan. Like, Lopan didn't die because of his hubris or because of, you know, any particular character flaw he had necessarily. It was just because Kurt Russell got it lucky. And I know he's a bumbling, stumbling hero character, but there was nothing satisfying about the finale. There was a whole lot of setup and no payoff. It was a very unhappy ending at this massage parlor. I'm sorry. It just wasn't really great. Lopan is more of an idea and less of a satisfying. There's no throw the emperor down the shaft moment. You know, there's no, you know, there's just that moment. He's right. Just all of a sudden dead.
And the end was actually pretty lengthy. I mean, the Raiden character chasing them while they're trying to escape seemed to take forever. You know, he could have killed them all very, very easily, but somehow getting down that hallway took him so long that they were all able to climb out and escape. But within all that, I think you're right. Like the Lopan moment, which should have been like the big supervillain that is going to take all this effort or whatever to defeat, was just with this quippy, like it's all in the reflexes thing. And maybe that's the point. Right, Bobby?
Yeah, I get that that's the point or something, but it still wasn't satisfying. Like it was more satisfying when the old peasant wizard fought him and they did the thing with the things and they were doing wiggling their fingers and then the terrible special effects were going across. Like even that was somehow they had some history there together and it was like a final confrontation. It was almost like a Darth Vader Obi-Wan moment, right? But when Jack Burton gets the Lopan, it's just, oh, it was all in the reflexes. He's dead. This guy's been around for 3,000 years or whatever. And this, all of a sudden he's just dead because he got a knife in the head.
That's hilarious, Robert.
There was no point at which you're supposed to laugh.
There's no reason for Jack Burton, who's a bumbling, smarmy guy, that's, as we've established, not particularly... He's more confident than he is skilled, but you love him anyway. If all of a sudden he knew kung fu, or all of a sudden, you know, he came up with some smart idea on how to defeat the final boss of the movie, That would not be typical of his hilarious, wonderful, charming character. And the callback to It's All in the Reflexes is your moment of satisfaction that you were looking for. And then making it more hilarious, there's a scene when all the little Chinese statues just kind of domino and he's just looking around like, what the hell is going on? I mean, I find it to be comic gold from Rumpelstiltskin's spinner thing.
Point of privilege. If you have to explain the joke, it's a bad joke.
You're the only person I've had to explain that to, Robert. Agree to disagree, sir.
Well, I am surprised, Robert, that you didn't have as much nostalgia for this, because I do remember watching this with you way back in the day, and so I thought it would have had some of that, but perhaps it just didn't stand out at the time.
Well, no, the overall spirit of the movie, I appreciate. It's just a fun romp with all kinds of wackiness. I enjoy that. I just don't think that it's better than the sum of its parts. It's a better idea than it is in execution. For me, maybe back in the day it was fantastic, and maybe I'm just a blind old man that can't see the genius through all the poor editing choices and the terrible dialogue and the hacky special effects. Maybe it's just my failures.
The fog of illness that you've been
taking. Yeah, I think you took too much Mucinex tonight.
It's possible.
Hopped up on the MX.
If I had been, you know, inebriated or otherwise altered during my experience of this movie, maybe it would be a bit better. But no, I didn't laugh a single time, and maybe I need to. I'm not going to watch it again.
Don't watch it. Please don't.
I'm not going to
watch
it again. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to put myself through that.
All right. Oh, well, let's go with final notes before we get into final summary and review. I don't know did anyone even take any notes? I know Robert.
Oh yeah.
Robert, you probably took a note or two. Bobby, you did.
I have final thoughts, but I feel like we've covered a lot of ground here tonight.
We have. We have established many things. But no, I didn't take any notes. Usually if there's some sort of economic point, I will write down a note for sure to remember to make sure to include. But as the case with most comedy movies, there's just not a lot to write down about. Although I think we had plenty of great banter on this episode. I'm really happy. Every time Bobby comes on with a strong opinion, I'm super happy about it. Especially when we clash. Let's do the thing, you and me, sir, and we'll find out.
We should have there and agree Bobby with each other all day. Movie marathon night one day, just so everybody.
I'm sure we'll probably find more movies that we agree upon than we disagree upon. We just happen to find the ones.
I think we agreed exactly on The Patriot. If that's worth anything to you, so.
Oh yeah, yeah, Patriot.
All right. What do you want to do now, Daniel?
Well, let's go with some scores. So how many Raiden electric charges are you going to give this thing, Robert, with your final summary review?
It's a movie with a whole lot of nostalgia. And if you got high nostalgia, you don't need my recommendation. You've already seen it. You already love it. You already know it. But if you're a new watcher and you're coming in looking for my opinion on whether you should check this movie out or not, I would say probably don't bother. If you're looking for a lighthearted romp, which this is, you know, check it out, I guess, but there are better things out there. The best reason to watch this movie is to go, you know, I've heard about this cult classic called Big Trouble in Little China. I want to check it out and see if it lives up to, you know, the hype of why this is still remembered as a thing that should be remembered or whatever. I think this movie lives on in other media better than it does in its own thing. There are video games where you can collect like a six demon bag. There are like quotes that are pulled from this movie. And there are other things that, like, obviously Raiden and Shang Tsung and that kind of thing live on in Mortal Kombat. So this movie has inspired, it has changed pop culture, but you know, it's people have taken little bits out of it and they've taken what they've liked out of it and passed that on in other better media. It's as a whole, it's not that great. It's better as little inspired ideas that you can take from it and enjoy. I would say that this is like, I can't give it a negative review because it's not a bad movie, but I can't give it a positive review. So this is a 5.0, boys. This is me sitting on the fence. This is the fence. This is me sitting on it. it's a movie. It's just a movie. It's better as a in within the rose colored nostalgia glasses on than it is for a first time watcher just checking things out. And maybe try not being a curmudgeonly old man when you watch it either. That's also good. And also, don't have watched a whole lot of movies previous to this. Like maybe this is like the first or second movie you've ever seen in your whole life. And then you'd be like, oh, what is this motion picture-y type thing? I'll check it out. Then you won't be disappointed.
Okay. But once you're an old man and curmudgeon-y like ourselves, then you've seen too much already.
Seen too much other better stuff.
Okay. All right. Do you think that this is one of those movies? Because, you know, Hollywood's always constantly doing remakes of things. Unnecessary remakes, I think, in many regards, like The Princess Bride, there's talk of that, and The New Matrix, and other movies along those lines, where it's like, why would you bother remaking something that was already so well done and indelible in the, you know, cultural, like, memory, other than to do, like, a cash grab or whatever? But this seems like perhaps this could be redone and maybe made a little bit more sense out of it. I don't know. Maybe it's a good candidate for that.
There's talk of having a remake with The Rock that's been talked about for years now. I'll see it, but I'm not going to like it. And they take all my favorite 80s action movies and remake them. Like, there's so many great premises out there that kind of fell flat that you could try to remake. But again, there's no audience appeal to it. And like you said, it's a cash grab. They did with RoboCop, Total Recall, Point Break, mm-hmm. all kinds of things like that. But yeah, there's definitely talk of Jack Burton being played by Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Yeah. Now there are from wrestling. Few, like remakes, or not even remakes, but like reboots or revisits to things like Blade Runner 2049, I think is mm-hmm. a good example. Or
which Mad I think Max was great.
Both of those are, yeah, they're both really good and well done. But they kind of bring back a lot of that nostalgia and like take those ideas that couldn't be technically as well done with the technology of the day and then reimagine them in some ways with updated technology to sort of like really show what they had in mind or, you know, have since developed like additional ideas. But I think both of those really worked well. I think the Dune remake, from the previews, it looks interesting, and because it's the same guy who did 2049.
Denis Villeneuve, yeah, he's awesome. I love that director right now. So
it's going to look great no matter what. I mean, I don't know about the story, but it's going to look amazing, that Dune movie.
Right. Well, I'll get into mine here. I recall this movie from when I was a kid, and so I had a little bit of that nostalgia for it. Also, I went through a period of, I think in the mid-2000s, when soundboards were a big thing, like those you'd go to a web page and there would be a little diagram or a little like big bingo board with different pictures of different characters and they would say different things. And I found a Big Trouble in Little China one, and it would do like, bring me the green-eyed girl, indeed, and some of the Jack Burton quotes. And so I had a little bit of that rubbing off on me for this one during the rewatch, which we watched the other night on the big screen TV in our bed. We got that set up with the new high-speed internet. With it came a package in which we can now kind of sort of like watch things not on an iPad anymore. So we had a more of a cinematic experience. But I did find myself to be a little bit lost in this one. So I think there are good parts to this. Kurt Russell is very likable in this, and he is kind of this over-the-top bravado, but yet buffoonish, cartoonish guy who can't really do anything, but he's very brave, but still likable. So overall, I think it's a good movie, but it doesn't make a lot of sense until you've watched it, thought about it a little bit, and then maybe watch it again. And to Snobby Bobby's point, I think that there are small things in here that you can find upon rewatching that might improve it. So I'm going to go with a 7 on this. So it's not as low as Robert. And I'm trying to do this progression so that we can go up to Snobby Bobby, who I'm sure is going to have a higher rating than 5 or 7. So Snobby Bobby, take it away.
There's a scene in an episode of The Simpsons where it's the episode where Troy McClure is playing the human in the Planet of the Apes musical. And in this scene, it cuts to Bart Simpson, and he's in the audience watching in amazement. And he says to himself, "This play has everything." That is me the first time I saw Big Trouble in Little China. It does have everything. Comedy, action, great characters with chemistry, a witty script, an insane premise, wacky set pieces, Kurt Russell, Victor Wong, a Bigfoot-type creature, killer soundtrack, Chinese human traffickers. It is the amalgam of everything I love about 1980s movies in one package. Normally, I do enjoy a movie that pulls on the strings of your brain, makes you think a little bit, has something to say. Nope, not with this one. And it doesn't fucking matter, because this is perfection of entertainment. 10 out of 10 lightning bolts. 10 out of 10.
Wow.
Wow. That's bold.
That's a score that is in the entertainment only category, right? Not in the film craft.
Yeah. Like I don't want to watch Turn Your Brain Off movies of today. I honestly like whatever when it comes to Marvel movies, or even like, I like how like for the word hipster means nothing now. You'll be like, oh, I'm not watching that fucking Transformers movie. That looks stupid. You're, like, you're a fucking hipster. I'm like, what? It's retarded. But like if as far as Turn Your Brain Off movies and just like enjoy the amusement park ride that is a movie, like for me, obviously not for Robert, this is it. This is the penultimate or the ultimate, right up there with The Golden Child, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. this is a great double feature with The Golden Child, by the way. Just throwing that out there.
Eddie Murphy. Yeah. Yeah. Didn't it have a very similar sort of story? I mean, in some ways, like it had.
Yeah. It's like that kind of mysticism, weird stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And they came out very near each other, like within the same 6 months or a year.
Yep. And fun fact, Kurt Russell turned down the role of McLeod in Highlander to be in this movie.
Interesting.
And was that Christopher Lambert instead from Mortal Kombat playing Raiden? There you go.
All right, loop it all together. Kevin Bacon's got to fit in there somewhere too.
I'll get back to you on that. Right. I don't think Chris Lambert played Raiden in Annihilation. Even he was like, I'm not going to be in this movie, Mortal Kombat Annihilation.
I've only heard horrible things. I don't know.
I've been craving that one lately. See how bad it really is. Yeah, it's Big Trouble in Little China is great. I don't know, like whatever, it's cool. We can still.
What
hang.
Kind of withered, angry, bitter soul would ever dislike Big Trouble in Little China?
I'd like to see your record collection.
Mm.
Do you have
Who
any
has records?
Do you have any like ABBA or like anything fun? Is there anything? Is it all just Yola Tango and Neutral Milk Hotel and stuff?
Exactly.
Coolio back in the day.
Just busted your chops. I love Coolio. Ski-Lo.
Fantastic Voyage. Come on, man.
Hell yeah.
Slippity Slide.
Mm-hmm. What happened to that guy?
I think he's still alive, right? He was doing some TV for a while. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not just Ice Cube.
Or maybe that's Ludacris or Ice-T. They're all, a lot of those guys do that.
Well, they all transferred onto TV pretty well. Ice Cube, Ice-T, they're all doing it. Or what? LL Cool J?
Yep. He's done a bunch. Yeah. Yeah. I watch those things. Or would.
No.
Ice-T was on CSI, was it? No, Law and Order for like fucking longer than his rap career.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Was that the SVU one? I don't even know. My in-laws watch that stuff.
It's good background noise. It's a good show.
Yeah. You don't really have to watch it. Just it's got to be on, like how Robert usually watches movies that we review.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's damn straight. That's how a movie should be experienced. On in the background, vaguely hearing things.
Perfect. Well, hey, I have one more note. My girls wanted me to mention it snowed here last night and all day today, and it's supposed to snow tomorrow. They just wanted everyone to know that there's snow on the ground. It's going to be Valentine's Day, and we're going to try to go sledding tomorrow.
Nice.
That's
lovely.
That's my contribution for this one.
How quaint. How quaint. It's actually snowed over there. I did it. There's been snow on the ground over here for like 5 months now. I don't want to hear about your dumb snow.
Oh, you guys are like far apart.
We're across the mountains from each other.
Yeah, 5-6 hour drive. Well, now it's even more because the road that would normally is only open this summer, and that's like the 4.5 hour. And now you got to go further south. So it's another 2 hours, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that. I'm sure the audience cares. They care so much that they can.
I'm sorry I asked.
They can hit us up on our Patreon over at lastnerds.com/Patreon. Also, we got a review recently. I should have pulled it up and had it ready for reading, but I'll have that on our profile page. It was a very glowing review, and we encourage those. We also got a new patron. So thank you for being our new patron, and we will be back next week, Robert, with Olaf the Narco Viking on one of his favorite films, Life is Beautiful.
Oh, man, a sappy love story with the Italian guy?
Yeah, the Italian guy. But he's in a Nazi concentration camp.
Oh, is it?
With his son. And the point is that he's making a game of it so his son doesn't realize the horrors that are going on all around them.
Oh, so he's like painting lipstick on the dead people and stuff?
I haven't seen it in a while, but I will watch it
this
week so that we record it. But
he's like kind of weakened and burning Bernie's all the dead guys and stuff. Okay. I'm looking forward to it now.
Yeah. You're really, really selling it. It's really selling on this one. Speaking of selling it, Snobby Bobby, sell our audience on listening to your show. I recommend it. I think that you guys do a great job.
Daniel recommends it. So. He has good taste. Check it out. It's on all podcatchers, not for everyone podcast. We cover more obscure titles of movies, and we do not talk really politics or news of the day or anything like that, unless we're kind of poking fun at it here and there. But try to be an escape from the woes of the world right now. Two guys palling around talking smack and watching weird movies, and Daniel recommends it, so there you go.
Yeah, that's all you need to know.
And I have bad taste, but I recommend it too. So
you don't have bad taste. I want, assuming that I will ever be asked back on the Last Niner / Actual Anarchy, here is my request. I want Robert to pick the movie, and I want it to be like his favorite movie. Or like just whatever, like one that you really like. So
have we ever done Pulp Fiction?
We did long ago. It's been a couple of years.
Oh,
okay. I would
like to get Bobby's take on that. Okay.
You'll have to wait for Pulp Fiction. There's a little cliffhanger that I just made up on your show.
Yeah. All about those cliffhangers, like we were talking about in the pre-show bonus content that we shared for all of our Patreon supporters. And we'll do a little bit of post-show content as long as Robert's got gas in the tank. But this has been our episode on Big Trouble in Little China. And we'll be back next week with Olaf the Narco Viking talking about Life is Beautiful. And with that, we'll say Happy Chinese New Year, Happy Valentine's Day, and good night from last night, everyone. Peace out. All right, and continuing the transmission for just a hair longer on the Actual Anarchy podcast. As we mentioned in the opening, Robert is on a couple of over-the-counter medications and still recovering from illness, so we probably won't be hanging out too much longer. But Robert, we certainly did shake the pillars of heaven tonight on this one, didn't we?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This was a good one. This is a lot of fun with our friend Snubby Bobby. He's an actual like professional at this kind of stuff. He makes us sound like we're just some startup know-nothings. So I always appreciate his take on things. And he's got an interesting taste in film that seems to have culminated in like 1987 or 1988, as if this is some sort of strange pinnacle. I don't know if that's because just the vibe at the time, or this is like the conflux of a bunch of great directors that he really liked. I don't know. I'd be curious to know if there were some modern films that he also appreciates in the same vein as the ones that have come in from the past.
Hmm.
Bobby.
Wait, what? I was in the bathroom.
I know.
Yeah, so we're doing the Actual Anarchy like final couple of minutes.
Yeah, right. Right, right.
Kathleen Turner.
What was the question?
Robert was curious. You have reverence for all these older films.
Sure.
What are some more recent films that
that's a good question.
Fill that same niche for you?
Kind of scratch the same itch?
Yeah.
That's a really good question. This is a weird answer, and it's not a good movie, but I found it to be endearing in that it did feel like kind of a 1980s action adventure movie, and I was not expecting to feel that way going in to see it. It was kind of a time killer, but have you guys seen Kong Skull Island?
Yes, I have.
I enjoyed it like very unexpectedly.
Really?
Robert?
Okay.
Robert?
Well, I thought it was a good looking movie. It was just a fun kind of a monster film. And mm-hmm, I enjoyed the mm-hmm. over the top aspects of Sam Jackson.
John C. Reilly.
Oh, yeah. John C. Reilly, too. That's the old lost guy on the island. Right. I would have to go back and watch it again. But what about it kind of reminded you of those days?
It was just kind of a cut and dry, like not trying to do anything spectacular or weird or different or interesting. Really, it's a very like paint by numbers action adventure sci-fi movie that, like, again, I had zero expectations going into seeing it, and I was very pleasantly surprised. I'm not going to say like I own it or I've seen it more than the time I saw it in the theater or anything like that, but like that would be an example of something I was pleasantly surprised by that reminded me of kind of the things I gravitate towards more. Another one that's I watch a lot, more of a horror itch scratcher, is Cabin in the Woods. Mm-hmm. Have y'all seen that?
I have. That Joss Whedon film, right?
Yeah. It's very much like a nod and a parody, and it's funny and it's insane, and it has a lot to say about the horror genre in general. And I don't want to spoil it for anyone that's never seen it, but it that movie is something I watch at least once a year. I watch Big Trouble Little China probably once a month, twice a month this month. I had to for the show, you know. I'm trying to think. That's a really good question, though. I very much enjoyed like Mandy, the Nick Cage movie that came out, just because it was so insane.
Is that like an interspace, like kind of horror, right?
Yeah, like, it's about a very weird kind of backwoodsy type people that are very much in love, and it's shot very kind of abstract, like I don't know what the word I'm like. It's very colorful. It's very like palettes of like pink and reds and stuff. But anyway, it's basically two movies in one. His lover Mandy gets kidnapped by like a religious cult, and there's just all these great scenes in it. It's incredibly insane, and the performances are so good for such an insane movie, where the first half is just her getting kidnapped and dealing with this, and then him like completely breaking down and trying to figure out how to rescue her. And then the last half of the movie is just pure, like, fun, crazy, violent insanity. It scratches both the kind of film geek aesthetic itch, or like, if you're looking for good performances or cool shots and things like that, someone that watches a movie more than just to, you know, be entertained. It has that, but it's also super entertaining by the end of it. So, that's a good one. I wish I had more time to prepare for that question, but yeah.
That's okay. That's okay. Just one last question for Bobby from the Peanut Gallery here. You spend a lot of your time on the podcast, at least kind of mining the past. Have you found that it's a never ending well, or I mean, there's a finite number of movies from which to draw.
That's a really good question. It's something I'm struggling with right now. And thank God for the internet and other people that are into the same weird shit that I am. Cause I don't have really have many people in my like normal, like in-person life, a few that are on the lookout to the degree that I am. And I think that that's part of the fun for me is, okay, so yeah, I mean, there is limited resources and I've kind of hit the bottom of the well, in more ways than one. But that makes it all the more gratifying when you do find that gem that like very few people have seen or very few people talk about anymore, or just even if it's like 90% like not watchable, but 10% of it is just insane. Like that does it for me. You know, I just want interesting. So whatever that means, it doesn't mean it has to be highbrow or heady or intellectual, which it could. But I just love like things that are just weird and catch you off guard. And there is a well, but like you have to mine through a lot of shit to get to the gold. Like I have these DVD collections that are like the B movie package. And it's like 200 movies that are probably in public domain now. And you have to kind of do like extensive research on which one of these are actually worth watching, things like that. So
like A Boy and His Dog.
Oh no, that's just absolute classic sci-fi movie. You watched that recently?
I did. Yeah, I watched it over Christmas.
God, I love that movie. God, I love that movie. Yeah, I love 70s sci-fi too. Like, I'm a huge. Well, I guess it's 68. Really, is Planet of the Apes is probably my favorite movie of all time, and then A Boy and His Dog, Space Odyssey, all that 70s Zardoz with which we're going to be doing an episode on soon, which is the
Connery, yeah,
Sean Connery with
the unitard.
The unitard and the guns, so weird. And I non-ironically like that movie. I was like, this is a great movie, but I get why people make fun of it, you know. So, and it has that too. So I don't know. I like anything that has like, you know, like a spaceship or like some sort of corridor that's like obviously cardboard with like blinking lights and ambiguous buttons and things like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, man. I'm with you. Our wavelengths are like tingling right now.
Good. Escape from New York is a good example of that kind of stuff. So if they ever remake that movie, I'm going to be fucking, that's sacrilege. So Robert, you've seen now the Holy Trilogy, even though John Carpenter did direct the Elvis movie, the made for TV Elvis movie with Kurt Russell. And he did do Escape from LA. I consider the Holy Trilogy to be The Thing, Escape from New York and Big Trouble, Little China. I'm going to go on a limb and say The Thing is probably at the top of your list.
Without question. Yeah, it's been a while, actually, since I've seen Escape from L.A. I think I saw Escape from New York, actually, more recently, but even that was a million years ago. So Snake Plissken is a name that kind of makes me smile, but I don't know. I don't remember it being a particularly good movie. But The Thing is eminently rewatchable. I don't even think that the remake is sacrilege, just because I want more Thing in my life. Mm-hmm. I just love that dynamic of not knowing who the bad guy is. And apparently there's a whole pile of people who agree with me, because there was recently, and not recently, it's been out for some time now, but Among Us, this little game that has been out for a long time, but caught fire thanks to, I guess, a couple of Twitch streamers or YouTubers that started playing it a lot. And the for a while game? There. Among Us, it's a video game as far as I know.
Oh, okay.
But it's all about, you know, there being one guy who's the Thing and everybody else tries to figure out who it is. And the Thing's got to kill everybody before they figure out who you are and they kill you. And it's a phenomenal dynamic and absolutely genius execution in the movie. Mm-hmm. So, man, I it doesn't get a whole lot better.
Yeah, I agree. There's a tabletop game called The Thing that's based on the movie that's very similar to, I don't know if you guys are into nerd shit like that, but
yes, I
really really good tabletop called The Thing. It was very expensive. I bought it just because it was The Thing, and then we actually played it. I'm like, this is a great game. But yeah, you can't fuck with The Thing. It's right up there. I think we've talked about it before ad nauseum, but it's just so good. It's just so good.
Do you know if it's still in production, that board game?
I don't know. It's possible. I bought it like right when it came out. I was just like, I got to get this. It was like $60. There's a whole movement now where they know who their audience is. Me being one of them is like these tabletop companies are getting licensing for like old horror movies and releasing board games for them. So there's like an Evil Dead one. There's The Shining, all kinds of shit. But the thing is like, it's, yeah, it has the gimmick of it being the thing, but it's actually really good. It's very similar to what you were describing in that video game where only one person is the thing and you have to kind of, they're in your party, but you have to figure out who it is in various ways.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. There's a similar kind of games with like Avalon and the Resistance where there are some of us are spies and some of us are heroes and whatnot. And you have to figure out who it is. But for those games, you need like five, at least people. So if it, do you know if the thing is, you can play it with two or three.
I wouldn't do any less than three, I don't think, which makes that makes it very, we haven't played it since all this horseshit started. So like, cause whatever, you know, so yeah, the more the merrier, I would say, because like other people can get infected and they have to keep it a secret too. Things like
sounds
that.
Sounds fun.
It's really good. But yeah, I would check that out. So I don't know.
All right, that's our,
I'm definitely going to check that. That sounds right up my alley. Like so right up my alley.
Yeah. And all the game pieces are like various, it's like each of the characters. And then there's like various incarnations of the thing to put on the board.
So fun. Fun. Yeah. Okay. Not to derail this show from too much, but all right. Yeah, I'm happy.
Write it down.
I'm checking it.
That's our
this is the part where we talk about anything.
Game recommendation moment there.
That's right.
It felt a little bit more like our Kathleen Turner Overdrive. So why don't we get into that? So Bobby, thanks again for coming on for this one. We love having you on. And I like your suggestion of having Robert pick a movie that is one of his favorites and then have you on for that. So please. We'll figure out what that is. And I think we are open in May or June. We're pretty filled out for the next while here.
All right. Excellent. I don't want to flood the market with me.
You can't get too much Bobby.
Yeah, too much Bobby. So anyway, everyone, thanks for joining us for this episode. This has been actualanarchy.com/220 will be the show notes tomorrow. We'll be back with Life is Beautiful next week with Olaf the Narco Viking. And we will catch you guys all next week. Maximum freedom, everyone. Peace out.
Chipmunks. Chipmunk. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do 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 do.